Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First up this morning, we have a competition for our listeners to win tickets to see the great Rod Stewart. Well, he's just announced additional tour dates for 2019, and he's going to play the Three Arena on the 4th of December, with tickets going on sale at 9 a.m. this coming Thursday. So the good news for our listeners is we've got a pair of tickets to Rod at the Three Arena to give away this morning. For your chance to win them, all you need to do is answer this question. One of Rod Stewart's best-known songs was Baby... What? Was it Baby Jane or Baby John? Text your answer A or B and your name and address to 51551, and I'll announce the winner before the end of today's show. But now we're going to begin with some live music, and here with me in our Studio 10 are the wonderful Henry Girls, all the way from the Inish Own Peninsula. They're otherwise known as sisters Karen, Lorna and Jolene McLaughlin. They're playing later today in Dublin as part of Tradfest. That is sold out because Tradfest has been such a big success, but you've joined me quickly to perform for us. Thanks so much for coming in, the three of you.
Oh, thanks for having us.
We'll have a little chat after a while, but first of all, off you go. You're going to sing one of your own compositions, yeah. A song called A Friend Like You.
Yes.
Things that we've been through, but in the dead of night, there's no end in sight. If I know I'm hurting you, when I'm pushing you away, I really wish that you would stay. Please forgive me, I'm trying to work it through and be kind to you, 'cause I don't want to lose a friend like you. On a mountain high, I close my eyes and think of how it used to be. If you needed me, I'd be at your side. I only hope that you know, when I'm pushing you away, I really wish that you would say, please forgive me, I'm trying to work it through and be kind to you, 'cause I don't want to lose a friend like you. I really wish that you would stay. Please forgive me, I'm trying to work it through and be kind to you. When I'm pushing you away, I really wish that you would stay. Please forgive me, I'm trying to work it through and be kind to you. A friend like you.
Oh, that was beautiful. Such a treat, actually. So early in the morning and your voices. It's a song of your own called A Friend Like You. I know it was on your last album, yeah. Far Beyond the Stars, but it's also featuring on a new compilation CD called Wild Atlantic Women, all from Donegal Women. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's a CD that was put together by a Donegal woman called Bree Carr. And she put it together because there was a young woman called Fiona Carr who'd passed away from cancer last year. And she was a sort of a colleague of Bree Carr's. Fiona would have been a very musical, talented young woman. And she died sadly last year. So in honour of her, Bree put this together. And it's featuring lots of Donegal women like Marie Aidan Mwaney from Alton, Moya Brennan from Clannad, Jackie Sharkey, Marie McCormick. There's loads. And yeah, so it's on sale now, and all the proceeds go towards Donegal Hospice because that's where Fiona was at the end of her life.
That's great. And it's called Wild Atlantic Women.
Wild Atlantic Women, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And well worth buying because it goes to such a great cause.
Absolutely.
Tell me about your annual residency at the Errigal Arts Festival.
Yeah, it's called Home with the Henry Girls, and we've done it now for a few years. And basically we invite people to come to Malin or hometown, which we love a lot. And so we, during the week, we do a lot of songwriting, a lot of singing sessions, and then in the afternoon then we go and sort of eat some nice food and go to the beaches and things like that, and then in the evening off to the pub or off to a concert or something. So it's part of Errigal Arts Festival. We've done it now a few times and it's been a great success. We get people from all over. We've had people from Germany, Austria, America, and it's lovely. So if you want to find out more about that, you can just go to our website and it's all there.
And what is your website?
Yes, it's the henrygirls.com.
Brilliant. And last thing, you've got two concerts. So you tell me about the Pepper Canister and the one with Antuanua.
Well, I'll tell you about the Pepper Canister, and maybe Karen will tell you about the Antuanua one. So the Pepper Canister is, you know, as you know, it's a beautiful church here in Dublin. And we've just announced that we're going to do a gig there on the 27th of April. So we're very, very excited about that. And the tickets actually just went on sale last night. So they're available to buy if you want to come. You'll get them at our website as well.
Eintok.
Yeah.
And then the Antuanua.
And then we've just been asked to be involved in a night in the Olympia Theatre. It's organised by Antuanua, the band, and it's called A Night for Aware. So it's a charity night, and there's lots of different bands. There's ourselves and Antuanua and the Blizzards and Ryan Sheridan. There's a whole load of ones, and I think the tickets maybe go on sale at the start of next month from Ticketmaster, so just keep an eye out for that. But yeah, that'd be a fun night. Yeah,
and another great cause. Well, look, you're three sisters. I gather you're three of six sisters, and your parents are listening this morning up in the Inish Opening.
Hello, Joe and Kathleen.
Yeah, a big shout out to your parents for producing all you wonderful, talented women. Listen, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having us.
All the best for the future. We'll take a break. Some reaction there to the Henry Girls, fantastic ambassadors for Donegal, the Henry Girls, an amazing group of people. Another of our listeners says, so beautiful and gentle, far beyond the stars. And another says, Paul McDevitt says, the cousins this morning, all the way from Donegal. Well, joining me now are three people who every day take great risks most of us just couldn't and wouldn't do. They are surgeons who every day make seemingly impossible decisions about our health, who operate under challenging circumstances and hopefully give us a better quality of life than before. And they're people that we have to trust implicitly at our most challenging moment, trusting in their training, experience and talent. Good morning to Dr. Kieran Bulger, Professor of Clinical Neuroscience at Beaumont Hospital here in Dublin, Dr. Helen Heenahan, Consultant Bariatric Surgeon at St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin, and Hannah Mullett, Consultant Orthopaedic Surgeon at Beaumont and at the Sports Surgery Clinic in Santry. You're all very welcome.
Thank you.
Hello. Thanks, sir.
Yeah, no, people are fascinated by surgery. I was saying that before we went in the air and you were all going, meh. Kieran Bulger, you operate on brains a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you are a brain surgeon.
Yes.
Like, what is that like?
I know, it sounds mad, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
No, it's like everything else, and like the others, I'm sure, it becomes what you do. You know, it's you don't want to be fazed by it. You can't go into work every day and go, oh my God, I'm a brain surgeon. You wouldn't be any good at it, you know? So it becomes, it's a work. Obviously, it's work at a particular level, but you have to treat it like work. You have to treat it that it's what you do, full stop.
Did you always, tell me about your trajectory, did you always want to be a brain surgeon? Did you
always
want
to be a
surgeon?
Doctor.
Okay.
So from when I was, I don't know, my parents had me three or four, I used to have little doctor kits with plastic stethoscopes and I was always taking people's temperatures. So I always wanted to be a doctor. And then the brain surgery thing came about much later. Then when I was in college, I was interested in the brain. I did a PhD in neuroscience. So I was into how the brain worked. And then when I did surgery, I liked surgery. So it seemed sensible to kind of marry the two of them, you know.
Helen, what's you're a bariatric surgeon. First of all, explain to people what that is.
So bariatric surgery is surgery for obesity and its complications. So it actually, in fact, it's probably more about the complications of obesity than weight per se.
And it's a growing area of surgery, isn't it?
Yes, growing in it's quite new to Ireland, but we're probably a couple of decades behind the rest of the world in terms of our approach to it and the volumes that we do. But yes, I'm lucky. It's the first appointed bariatric surgeon to the HSE. With that as my main specialty, a number of other surgeons have the skill set to do it. But yeah, it's my dream job.
And did you always want to be a surgeon? I know we're sitting with two male surgeons here. Is it traditionally primarily a male profession?
Very much so. Yeah. I think 7% of consultants in Ireland are female. And that's probably probably comparable around the world. We're a little bit behind again. But no, I can't remember when I didn't always want to be a doctor. I think once I started medical school, I realised I wanted to be a surgeon. I liked surgeons. And there was a brilliant professor of surgery in Galway at the time where I trained, who I found quite inspiring. And that's where I first saw bariatric surgery. So it started there.
And what is, give me an example of an operation you do, because I don't know much about bariatric surgery.
So yeah, most people don't. I still have to spell it on a day-to-day basis at work. But it's surgery on the gut. So gastric bypass, sleeve gastrectomy, with the intention of helping people lose weight and treat conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, cholesterol, lower cancer risk. I could go on.
Okay. Hannan Mullett, you've a fantastic name, but you actually hail, your family comes from Kerry.
Well, I'm lucky in that my mother is from North Kerry, my father's from Dublin, so that's a good combination.
Very. And when did you decide you wanted to be a surgeon? You're an orthopaedic surgeon.
Yeah, I think my grandfather was an engineer and I used to spend a lot of time tinkering in his workshop when I was a young boy. So I always knew I wanted to do something practical. And then as a medical student in St. Vincent's Hospital, I spent a rotation with the orthopaedic surgeons. And I found, unlike some of the other teams, they seemed to be very happy in their work and they had great enthusiasm. And then when I got into orthopaedic surgery, everybody I met seemed to be very happy with their lot and got great work satisfaction. So, I mean, and I think now almost, I've been a consultant for 14 years. I still have the same enthusiasm that I did when I started.
And you, would it be correct to say, Hannan, you specialise now a lot in shoulders?
Yeah, well, so my area is trauma and orthopaedic surgery. So we deal with all kinds of musculoskeletal trauma, but also the more degenerative conditions. So I have a great variety in my work in that I could be dealing with somebody who's a victim of a car crash, you know, who's, for example, shattered their leg one day. And then the rest of the time I might be dealing with degenerative conditions, you know, somebody who needs a shoulder replacement if they've arthritis and pain and restricted movement. Or else, you know, my specialty then is in sports injury. So I might be operating on a sports person and trying to get them back on the field as soon as possible.
Is trauma, the operations you have to do after a trauma and accident, is that more stressful for you than maybe dealing with somebody who obviously has a shoulder injury, a rugby player or something? Which is more stressful?
Well, they both have separate stresses. If you're dealing with a trauma case, you have to make decisions, often very important decisions, in a stressful environment. But, you know, I've been doing that for a long time, so although there are variations, most of the trauma cases you've been through it before. If you're dealing with, for example, a professional athlete, obviously, if the operation doesn't go well, that can be a career threatening event. So that has its own stresses, and there's a lot of apart from the player, there's other stakeholders. There's the team, coaches and managers and physios. So there's a lot of people interested in the outcome of the surgery.
Looking at you, hoping it's all going to go great.
That's for sure.
Karen, brains. I know this is going to sound like a really stupid question, but do all our brains look the same?
Yes, right. Absolutely. They all look the same. And, you know, but we were talking about risks and making decisions and, you know, stress. I put it in context. My brother is an electrician and he makes the point that if I make the wrong decision, somebody else dies. If he makes the wrong decision, he dies. That kind of puts the risk bit into context.
That's really interesting, actually. But before you operate, can you remember the first time you operated on somebody's brain?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah.
So you start off like anything else. You start off very basic. So the first operation you get to do on someone's brain is a brain surgeon. And before you do this, you've already done general surgery. Or at least I had, is a simple thing of drilling a hole in someone's head, usually to take out some blood, so people have a blood clot. So the easiest operation, safest operation we do is just to drill a hole in the skull. So you're not actually operating on the brain itself. So, and then you work up from there. So as you get more experience, you get to do more and more and more complicated operations. But that's the first one you do as a brain surgeon.
What are the most complicated form of surgery in the brain? What's the one that not tests you, but it's very...
So the,
difficult.
I think the hardest ones are the ones with the biggest risk and the biggest risk of causing damage, trying to get something out. And when it comes to that, there's a part of your brain called the brainstem. So tumours in and around your brainstem are very difficult to operate on because they're very risky. And they're risky because the brainstem isn't the kind of clever part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that makes you take a breath when you need a breath. It's the part of the brain that keeps your heart beating regularly. So if around that area is kind of complex anatomy. There's like small blood vessels, tiny little blood vessels, but if you take one of them, somebody's going to have a stroke, you know? So I'd say that's probably the most difficult area to work in. But all different parts of the brain have different problems. So you could be operating at a higher, easier, if you like, technically a bit, but it's besides the person's speech area. So you might have to wake them up to make sure that you're not damaging their speech area as you're taking out a tumour. But so every part of the brain has its own little complexities and its own little problems.
Do you ever get stressed? I mean, even the thought of it is stressful, working in...
Funnily enough, the stress that I get in work has nothing to do with the surgery. The surgery is the easy part. I'm in my own world off in operating. The stress is when your patient is cancelled, when they don't have a bed, when, you know, something happens outside of the operating theatre. In fact, I don't know about you, but the operating theatre is the least stressful part of my life.
Absolutely.
Is that what you find too, Helen?
Yes, it's also the one you get no training in. We're well trained, you know, through the years working through from an intern through to being a registrar. Particularly in Ireland, we've a really good training system, but you're not so well trained for managing other people. and at an administrative level, that's way more challenging. You've so little control over it, and we like being in control generally.
Yeah.
And Johanan, what's the most stressful bit for you?
I think probably working in the HSE, there is a level of frustration with the lack of efficiency and, you know, patients being cancelled and not being able to deliver through on what you've kind of promised the patient. I find that stressful.
Mm.
Having said that, I think we tend to, you know, there tends to be a lot of negativity around the HSE and there are challenges with, you know, patients accessing services. But I think once they... Get into the hospital. I think the level of our specialists is on a par with anywhere in the
Everyone
world.
Everyone says that.
I think, you know, I've worked in other countries such as the US and the UK and our nursing staff are second to none, I think, also.
Do you need a lot of confidence to be a surgeon? I mean, you can't really doubt yourself, can you? Like, you've got to keep your nerve.
You have to be a bit of an idiot. I mean, you do have to believe in yourself. No, you do, because if you weren't self-confident, you wouldn't be any good at it. You know, if you couldn't be questioning yourself every day going into theatre, am I able to do this? Am I able? You know, so you do have to be a bit of, have a little bit of arrogance. Not too much, but enough that gets you into the theatre to do the job.
I think also, I mean, that I think that arrogance is tempered by the humility of when things go wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
As I get further on, you know, in patients, when it doesn't work out, it's very humbling.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you deal with that when, I suppose, either the person you've operated on or the people who love them? How do you deal with telling them?
I suppose that's one of the most challenging things, is either dealing with, you know, patients who are disappointed with the outcome of surgery, or, you know, if the worst comes to worst and the patient doesn't survive, they have their different stresses.
Are you taught early on, Helen, in law, in medical school, how to deal with that? In other words, you have to be a certain kind of person to be a surgeon, and yet you need this incredible empathy and compassion as well to deal, I suppose, with the very sad cases when things don't work out.
Yeah, I think every subspecialty, even outside of surgery, requires empathy and has those challenges. Certainly through our training, we do get trained in simple things, how to break bad news, how to deal with, I think we're told how to deliver that. It still doesn't make it much easier when it does happen. I think even certainly as someone, like, I'm quite young into my career, and I still struggle with that. I still expect everything to go perfectly, and when it doesn't, it's really difficult.
Yeah, and increasingly the patients kind of expect everything to be perfect as well. I mean, there's kind of a things have changed in that people now don't expect to be sick. They don't expect to have anything wrong. And you feel a lot more anger from patients when they have a bad diagnosis, when things aren't perfect. And, you know, life just isn't perfect. And I can't make it all the time perfect, you know. And so there's a bit of that as well. It's trying to explain to people that, you know, what's happened to them, the best you can do for them, which isn't always everything. It's not that you can cure them or whatever, but you can try and keep them comfortable. You can try and extend their life as long as possible, particularly with things like tumours and that. So that's the hard part of dealing with people. But you do have to have empathy, and you do have to take the patient's view of things into consideration when you're making decisions. And that's an increasing thing as well. When I started training, the patient was kind of, you know, the surgeon made the decision and hardly discussed it with the patient sometimes. Now it's very much a shared journey. And if you're going to do anything, you know, you go through it carefully, you give them the options. Sometimes the options aren't that nice, but it's their decision and you work with them.
And I suppose all operations are risky, but if you're doing what you do, Kieran, which is brain surgery,
yeah,
sometimes the risks must be greater.
Well, the risks are greater, but the problem, so it's always a balance. So you've got the risk of operating, but then you can balance that about, well, what'll happen if I don't operate? So when people are, like, nobody has a brain operation just for the sake of it. So, you know, the balance is, if I don't take out this tumour, the tumour's going to finish you off. So we need to try and take out the tumour. So there's big risks of the surgery, but that's tempered by the option of not doing it, which is, you know, worse.
Has brain surgery changed a lot since you began doing it?
I think, like all surgery, it's gotten more minimally invasive. It's gotten, people are trying to do less and less damage on the way in. We use computers much more. Computers weren't a big thing when I started, but computers now are a big fact of planning surgery. We use computers, we use computer guidance while we're in the brain to show us exactly where we are, that kind of thing. So it's become more technological and less invasive. The time.
You can also never, any of you, I'll stay with you, Kieran, be tired. Like, you know, most of us can go into work someday and, I don't know, be a bit tired and hide it. But, like, you've all three, you've got to be so sharp. Like, if you're operating in someone's brain, there's no margin for you saying, I'm a bit tired today.
Surgeons aren't any different as people to anybody else. We all get tired and we have frustrated, might have been out too late last night. But what I think surgeons are very good, or good surgeons are very good at, is you leave that at the door. So you might be frustrated in the coffee room, but by the time you get into the operating theatre, that's put behind you. And you learn that very early on. You have to be a bit of a robot, you know, once you start the work, and leave all that behind.
Do you find that, Hanum?
Yeah, I think one of the attributes of surgeons generally is that they have very good stamina, probably due to the arduous training.
Yeah.
And that kind of toughens you for the journey ahead.
How do you do work-life balance? In other words, say you've operated on someone, any of you, and it hasn't gone well. Like, I think I'd take it home with me. But then if you've got children, you inflict that on them. How do you get the work-life balance right?
Yeah, I'm lucky. I have a wonderful wife and four beautiful daughters. So when I go home, that's a busy household. So you quickly forget about work in the mayhem when you go through the door.
And are you able to compartmentalise your life?
Yeah, I think it's very important, because you can't be kind of coming home and being cranky because you've had a bad day at work when there's five other people dependent on, you know, having a quality of life as well. But I think it's important also to have interests outside of medicine, I'm interested in sport, to both watching it and participating in it, and, you know, other areas of life. It's very important.
You have?
I think it is really challenging. So, no, certainly I'm not as good as I'd like to be at work-life balance, but my husband's a surgeon as well, so he's incredibly understanding. So,
do you both discuss surgery all day and night?
Yeah. I try not to. If I start, he stops me really quickly. But you could, but that would be terrible.
Yeah. So,
no, it's, and like I said, we have the same interests as anybody else outside of work. Just maybe not enough time to to give them.
Do you find it difficult to strike a work-life balance?
Yeah, I think as Hannon says, though, you just have to compartmentalize things. Often, though, it will flow over. Like just this week, I was supposed to be doing something with my family and with my parents, and I had to go in and do an operation. So I had to get my sister to go and cover me while I was in operating, which messes up her evening. Do you know what I mean? So it does impact, but you have to try and minimise that and kind of have two separate existences, you know.
Yeah. One of our listeners says, brilliant surgeons, they're all three, but the two brilliant men there have been impacted on my life. Dr. Mullet confirmed I had a spinal tumour and Dr. Bulger saved me from a lifelong wheelchair, C3 and C7 removed, and I swam 50 lengths yesterday. Such respect, admiration and gratitude. That's from Laura. I suppose at the end of the day, that's why you all do it. Yeah, fantastic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, look, I hope to never see any three of you in a hospital, especially you, Kieran Bulger, to be honest, as a brain surgeon. But thanks so much to all three of you for coming in today and sharing your life thoughts and
you're
your
welcome.
Career.
Thanks
so
pleasure.
Much. Thank you.
What you do is absolutely superb. We'll take a break. Bring you one text there in our surgeons. Kieran Bulger, the brain surgeon. Well, he transformed my niece Aoife's life. After multiple back operations, she ended up in a wheelchair. Kieran took on her case and now she's living a full life. She got married last year. She's a beautiful little girl. We're also indebted to Kieran and he's great fun too. Maybe he's a terrible singer though. That's from Mary. Well, look, we move on to Rod Stewart, the wildly successful and some might say the successfully wild singer and songwriter of bucket loads of hit records that we all know and have sung along with over the decades. He's been a star. And thankfully, unlike other singers of his generation, he shows no sign of retiring. As later this year, Rod Stewart has added two extra dates to his Páirc Uí Chaoimh date in May. As he's just announced, he's going to be in Dublin on December the 4th and in Belfast on December the 2nd. And I'm delighted to say that I spoke to Rod earlier on the phone. Good morning, Rod Stewart. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Miriam. So lovely to hear your dulcet tones.
And look, you're coming, I know, to Páirc Uí Chaoimh in May, but then you're now going to come to Belfast and Dublin on the 2nd of December in Belfast and the 4th of December in Dublin. Are you looking forward to those dates?
Always, always. I'm not blowing smoke up your bottom, but there are a few audiences I absolutely adore, Dublin, Belfast and Glasgow. Oh, and of course, I better say London.
Yeah, I think people say Dublin audiences are good. They're kind of, I don't know, warm, engaging.
Yeah, they absolutely are. They have a few drinks, which is essential at one of my shows, and just all join in. You know, it won't be a lot of old stuff because that's, after all, what they've come to listen to. But, you know, we're just having done a number one album. We would like to do a couple of songs from Blood Red Roses.
Yeah, and that album has done so well. Is it difficult to keep doing successful albums down the decades? You seem to have succeeded in doing so.
Well, yeah, obviously I don't sell records like Adele or a few other people, but, you know, I've had what I always say, you know, I might not have sold 20 million, but I've had a really good run at it. So I make albums now for my friends, you know, which are my fans, and they seem to love it, especially in Great Britain. And I don't know what the next move is. I don't know if I'll be doing a country album or a big band album. I'm not going to write the next one. I just want to do something different.
Do you mind going back for a moment, just for our listeners, Rod? Tell me about your mum and dad, actually.
Mum and dad. My dad was a Scotsman from Edinburgh, Leith in Edinburgh. My mum was a Londoner. And they were great parents, and of course we were a footballing family, and both my brothers, my uncles, my grandfather, everybody played football, so I had no option but to. But I had a very, very loving family. They're both gone now. Dad died in 90, I think, and Mum went over about a few years later. I miss them, especially my dad, because he was a football fanatic. He got me into football, and he was never a Celtic supporter like me and my boys. He was a Hibs supporter, obviously, because he came from Edinburgh.
And did he resent the fact that his great son supported Celtic?
No, not at all. Not at all. No, I don't. No, he loved everything about Scottish football. My mum was upset with football because through the years, football has caused so many arguments in the household. you know, my brothers played the day before they get married, and my dad broke his leg on Boxing Day. And my mum always said that football caused more rows in the Stuart household than Hitler.
Yeah, and obviously in Scottish, in Scotland, football, of course, it really is like the more important thing in life.
Life and death.
Is it apocryphal that you were discovered on the train platform playing your harmonica? I've read it a lot. Is it true or not?
Oh, absolutely true. It was in my book, Rod, the autobiography, which is still available in shops, ladies and gentlemen. yeah, absolutely. I'd been down to, see Long John Baldry and the Hoochie Coochie Men. And Cyril Davis, and I was on my way back, and John was on the opposite platform, and he heard me playing the harmonica, and he came over, and as he describes it, his description was, I saw this great big heap of clothes sitting on the floor with a nose pointing out, but playing a beautiful harmonica, and he said, would you like to come and play harp and sing? And so I did, and so he gave me my first break.
Long John Baldry.
Good old Long John. Gay as Christmas he was. Gay as Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Changing ways, so-called liberated days. A story comes to mind of a friend of mine. Georgia boy was gay, I guess. Nothing more or nothing less. The kindest guy I ever knew. His mother's tears fell in vain. The afternoon George tried to explain that he needed love like all the rest. Paul said there must be a mistake. How can my son not be straight after all I've said and done for him?
A lot of people have different songs they love of yours. I love the song The Killing of Georgie. Did the fact that you were surrounded by a lot, I suppose, of gay people, including Long John, did that add to that song, do you think? I know there was a story anyway.
Yeah, it was. I was surrounded by a lot of gay people, and I was very young. I never got touched, by the way. But I loved the humour of the gay community in those days, and I still do. But Killing of Georgie, yeah, we've actually put that back in the show, so you'll hear that in Dublin. Was a true story about a good friend of the Faces. He was more a friend of Ian McLagan's than mine, but he used to come around a hotel room, a good-looking guy, great-looking black guy, and turn us on to all sorts of music, you know, at the time. You know, have you heard this? Have you seen this? That's where the story came from.
Everybody loves Georgie Boy.
And, like, that's 42 years ago. It is about a man who knew.
How long ago?
42 years ago, Rod.
Jesus Christ almighty. Lord have mercy on us.
But it had, you know, it had a very important effect. So I spoke recently to Boy George, and I don't know if you know this, but, you know, his mom gave him a copy of that song as a way of letting him know that she knew he was gay and that she supported him.
That's very touching, very, very touching. And a lot of guys have come up to me and said, look, I've got to tell you this. I was in a black place until I heard that song. I was in a dark corner, frightened, you know, until I heard that song. And then I puffed up my chest and became proud of who I am.
Yeah, no, it means so much. Your other songs that people love, I mean, I'll talk about Grace in a minute because you're going to sing that here in Ireland. But
oh, you betcha.
What about your song Maggie May? I mean, remind people, do you mind, Rod, of the story behind that song?
Oh, it's a little rude, but I'll tell you anyway. It was the Bewley Jazz Festival in the 60s, and I went down there and, you know, as a beatnik. And everybody in those days, like today, had tents, not quite so luxurious as they do now at festivals. But there was this little on the large side girl, and she offered me into her tent. And I was a virgin, and that's where it took place. All that over in about 12 seconds, I would imagine. I don't know if her name was Maggie, but it left an indelible, you know, imprint on my life. So it was worth a song.
And a beautiful song.
Yeah, it is, I suppose, in a way. I've never thought of it like that, but yes, it is.
Wake up, Maggie, I think I got something to say to you. It's
late September and I really should be back at school. I know I keep you amused, but I feel I'm being used. Oh, Maggie, I couldn't have tried anymore. You led me away from home just to save you from being alone. You stole my heart, and that's what really hurts. The morning sun, when it's in your really shows your age, but that don't worry me none. In my eyes, you're everything. I laughed at all of your jokes. My love, you didn't need to coax. Oh, Maggie, I couldn't have tried anymore.
Do you enjoy playing your hits that have been yours, I suppose, for decades, as much as ever? I spoke to Van Morrison recently, and he was saying sometimes your very, very big hits can almost become a burden. Do you find that or not?
No, not really, because, you know, you get a different reaction every night, and it's like playing to a fresh audience. I've always called my songs children, because you build them, you give birth to them, you nurture them, and then you throw them out into the public. Well, not throw out children, but they leave and go out into the public, and you're always interested in them to see how they're doing. Now, I'm not... Maybe do you think I'm sexy? I sometimes get a little bit tired, but when we play that song live now, we just have a lot of merriment, and it's usually the end of the show.
And do you enjoy, when you now are coming to Ireland, do you enjoy touring as much? Or do you almost enjoy it more these days?
Well, that's a hard one, because touring in the old days was a lot different than it is now. For instance, in the old days, I didn't have 8 children, and you know, and I miss the young ones, you know, the 12-year-old and the 7-year-old. And what I do now is I tour in between when they're having their holidays, or when I'm only like an hour's flight away from home.
From my window, stay away from my back door too. Disconnect the telephone line. Relax, baby, and draw that blind. Kick off your shoes and sit right down. Loosen up that pretty French gown. Let me pour you a good long drink.
has it changed a lot? It's, apart from travelling everywhere in a private jet, no, it hasn't. It's a bigger production. Tours are longer. You have to play much longer than you did with when I was with the Faces. We used to do 3/4 of an hour. And now you have to do 2 hours. I like to do 2 hours. So that's why I've just come out the gym. I keep myself fit. I do a lot of, altitude training now I'm starting to do. And I've just built an indoor pool. I just come out the pool, 22 laps. I do everything, 3 times a week. Then I have my lunch and then I have to have a sleep.
Sounds good. How do you mind your voice? I was reading, obviously, articles for this interview and lots of people remark on your voice. They say, to describe it, it has a profound tenderness and compassion, something kind, warm and close. But how do you look after it? It's a very distinctive voice.
I don't really have to do much when I'm not touring, but when I am touring, it can be a nightmare sometimes, you know. I'd love to go out with the band for a drink after a show, but I can't. I have to go to my room, go to sleep, and drink tons of water. Sleep and water are the answers to keeping your voice perfect. And it's difficult, you know. You have to be very regimented with it. I warm up for about an hour and a half, then I warm down for 20 minutes after every show, and I can do 4, sometimes 5 shows a week for 2 hours. But it is, who was it, Pavarotti said, when you're on tour, you are a prisoner of your voice, and you are.
Interesting. You also said in your memoir, Rod, that you and the Queen have something in common. You've both had the same hairstyle for 45 years. How important has your hair been to you?
Well, thank goodness that it's stayed where it's supposed to be, and I'm very, very, very thankful for that. It is. I look after that as well. I get it cut every 2 weeks. I don't wash it too much with shampoo. I just shampoo it like maybe once a week. I do water it down to get it in shape, but that's about it. It takes me 5 minutes to get my hair ready.
Well, it's been
5 minutes.
It's been very good to you. It's like still,
it has.
So, yeah. Tell me about.
I'll look in the mirror this afternoon. I'm going to thank it dearly.
Yeah, do. Tell me about how you heard about the song Grace, because obviously it's a beautiful song and very much an Irish song.
Oh, very much so. Well, I was at Celtic Cup final, Hampden Park in Glasgow, and they started singing it. And I thought, oh my God, that song's lovely. And every time I heard it, I thought, what it is. I found out what the song was called. It was about 3 or 4 years ago. And so I learned the song, and I thought, well, I'd love to record this, but before I record it, I went over to Dublin and visited Kilmainham Jail and the chapel and all the sites of the rebellion, the uprising, the Easter uprising. So I knew what I was singing about. Mm. And I intend to do a lot more historical touring when I get back there. And I fell in love with the song. I've sung this song at Madison Square Gardens, and I go, is there anybody from the Republic here? And as you know, they all say, yeah, it's Ireland after all. And you can hear a pin drop when I sing it. Mm. Whereas some of the other songs I sing, new songs, you know, they just say, well, I know that's on a new album, but let me hear the old stuff. But with Grace, you can hear a pin drop.
Gather in the chapel here in old Kilmainham Jail. I think about these past few weeks. Oh, will they say we failed? From our school days, they have told us we must yearn for liberty. Yet all I want in this dark place is to have you here with me. Oh, Grace, just hold me in your arms and let this moment linger. They'll take me out at dawn and I will die. With all my love, I play on your finger.
there won't be time to share our love, for we must say goodbye.
It's a gorgeous, gorgeous song. Probably one of the most tragic love songs, or it is the most tragic love song I've ever recorded.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Or ever sang. Oh, it is, yeah.
It's so interesting. You made the effort to go to Kilmainham Jail. Why did you do that?
I just read the story. I read a load of books. I went out and bought a load of books about the uprising and read about the couple. And I thought, I've got to go and see all this. The GPO, where they held out, and all of the history behind it. And I was there for a whole day, flew in and flew out, went to some great pubs. Dublin's got the best pubs in the world, the prettiest pubs I've ever seen. Anyway, that's incidental. I can't wait to sing Grace.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful interpretation. We spoke earlier about all your own songs you've written, but you also interpret other great songs like Grace. How do you decide what interpretation you're going to do of someone else's song? How do you put your own stamp on it?
That's a God-given thing, really. It's something I was given. When I was born, I was able to sing, and I've honed in on it, worked at it. But the most important thing for me is lyrical content before melody. That's why I picked Grace. Grace has got a beautiful melody, but the words are poignant, absolutely beautiful. But, I can't sing dumbass lyrics, although some of my songs have been a bit dumbass, really, I suppose. Hot Legs was a bit silly. But I was a young lad. I was playing the room, so...
kept yourself grounded in, I suppose, rock and roll. It's a bit of a crazy world. You've been very happy married for a long time to Penny, 8 children, 2 young boys, Alistair and Aidan. How do you stay sound and sensible in a mad world?
I just think I was born that way. Even in the heyday of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, I never really was into drugs. I dabbled. Mm. I use the word dabble because I played football. I played football all my life, and the two don't go together. Even alcohol and football don't go together, obviously. But so I've always kept myself level-headed, and I've got a great deal of friends around me. Hardly any of them in show business. They're just mates I've had for years, and I don't take any liberties. I don't come the big Charlie. They bring me down to earth, and so do my two brothers and my sister. And of course my wife does. She's a good working-class girl from Chigwell, and she keeps me in my place. But I just think I'm just a guy that's very thankful for what I've got, and the public have given me this lovely, lovely lifestyle that I've got, and I'll be forever thankful to them. Does that sound right?
No, it sounds great. Final question before I mention your dates again, Rob. When you look back on your life, do you think you've been very lucky?
Well, you better believe it. It's something I think about quite a lot. I drive into London and me Rolls Royce, I see everyone struggling going to work. I thought, oh my God, you lucky bugger. In saying that, hopefully I've given them something back as well. Given them something to smile about, something to cry about and think about in my music.
I didn't know what day it was when you walked into the room. I said hello, unnoticed. You said goodbye too soon. Breezing through the clientele, spinning yarns that were so lyrical. I really must confess right here, the
The attraction was purely physical. I took all those habits of yours that in the beginning were hard to accept. Your fashion sales, beards, lip prints, I put down to experience. The big bosom lady with a Dutch accent who tried to change my point of view. Her ad-lib lines were well rehearsed, but my heart cried out for you. You're in my heart, you're in.
And you still want your ashes cast over Celtic?
Right, on the penalty spot.
And look, Rod, you're playing the SSE Arena in Belfast on the 2nd of December and the 3 Arena in Dublin on the 4th. And tickets go on sale this coming Thursday, the 31st of January.
Indeed they do.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us this morning. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And loads of reaction from our listeners. They seem to like Rod a lot. Miriam, that's one of the most beautiful renditions of Grace. I'm in tears here. Well done, Rod. Another Pat McLaughlin says, phew, fighting back the tears listening to Rod Stewart singing Grace. I'm a lifetime fan since I heard Maggie May in the 1970s. Another listener, Margaret, says, Miriam, Rod Stewart is just wonderful in the way he's interpreted the song Grace. He's a true artist and brings joy to so many people. And another, Aoife, says, Miriam, I first heard Baby Jane on vinyl for my 11th birthday. My dad borrowed some cool records from a young lad in his work, and I had a disco in the sitting room with my friends. I've loved Rod ever since. Well, look, the winner of our competition today to go to Rod Stewart, two free tickets, is Jennifer Hughes in Palmerston in Dublin 20. Congrats to Jennifer.